The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
The Bob Seska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com. Broadcasting from Resistance Headquarters, relentlessly fighting back against the clown dictator and his regime of deplorables.
Never give up, never surrender.
This is The Bob Seska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, January 16, 2019, and this is the Bob Seska Show, interviews from Earth One. My guest today is Dr. Leah Torres. She's a Utah-based OBGYN who also happens to perform, gasp, abortions. On top of that, she's a women's rights activist as well as specializing in the promotion of sexual health. So today's show will cover everything from abortion to anti-choice laws, and we'll dig into human sexuality with an expert in human anatomy. By the way, you can follow Dr. Torres on Twitter at Leah N. Torres. And be sure to follow hashtag DocSplaining on Twitter. And if you like what you hear, please consider supporting this show at patreon.com/join/Bob Seska Show. And now let's talk with Dr. Torres. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really, really appreciate it. I've been dying to talk to you ever since you were a guest on Kimberly Johnson's podcast almost a year ago. And I was like, oh, I got to talk to Dr. Torres myself on my own show because I have so many questions. Yeah, I noticed just to start out here, I noticed on your Twitter that, yeah, you've seen the new Gillette commercial. How many times do we have to tweet not all men before the men's rights crowd gets the message that it's not all men, that it's just the toxic, poisonous ones that we all know of?
I mean, that's the thing is, and, you know, I don't know if you saw a comment by several male celebrities. I'm thinking of Idris Elba specifically, but, you know, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to worry about.
Right.
And I think that all of the defensiveness is because those folks have done something that they know that they shouldn't have. You know, what's more is that they know they shouldn't have done it. Right. So that guilt is coming out. They're projecting onto others saying, I'm not like that. Well, if you have to say that you're not like that, you probably are.
Yeah.
Because your actions are going to speak louder than your words, you know? Yeah. So. Yeah, it's tiring.
Right. Dost thou protest too much? I think that's the case a lot of these guys. And a lot of them are just overly offensive or offended or easily offended or overly defensive. I mean, just there's an entire array of reactions, and not just people who feel, the pang of guilt for their own behavior, but ones who feel like, oh yeah, all those women, they're coming for us. I mean, I saw a clip yesterday on the Joe Rogan podcast where his guest was basically saying, well, eventually we're not going to have penises anymore. Seems like, oh my God,
I mean,
talk about hysterical. Yeah.
Like, I don't know why the reaction is, oh my God, everybody hates me, and not, oh my God, why would women have to live with this? This is wrong. You know, call out your own. Don't protect the bad ones. Like, I don't understand the reaction at all, to be honest.
Sure. And it seems to me as if there's one question that you could ask, and it would seem like this would pretty much prove the case that's being made by Gillette and so many other people, especially now, which is that name one global atrocity that was not perpetrated by a man. So to me, see, that's the illustration. That's what we're talking about here. We're talking about sexual harassment, and we're talking about bullying, and we're talking about, you know, thousands and thousands of years of warfare and destruction and genocide, mostly perpetrated at the hands of men who feel like that they're entitled to do all of those things because of whatever, you know, because of the status that they've been offered either biblically or societally or whatever. It's so immensely frustrating to observe.
They're writing those history books, right, too. So
yeah,
it's their version of the story that gets told. And it's not both sides. And I mean, look how, you know, just look at the Crusades, and look at Christopher Columbus, and look at all of these horrible things that happened. But yet the story was spun such that, oh, Christopher Columbus discovered America. Well, A, no.
Right.
B, he killed a lot of indigenous people.
So, exactly.
You know, it's also important to see who's telling the story as well.
So, Dr. Torres, you're an OBGYN, and, you know, I'm always curious about why doctors choose their specialty. I mean, what made you decide to go into that particular, that specialty? Was it always your ambition, or was there, like, an inciting incident that led you to that field?
Well, I get asked this a lot, and I always sort of remember being in college. In college, in high school, I was already planning on pursuing medicine. So, in college, I was doing just the prerequisites and all that stuff, planning on going to medical school. But as is required in a liberal arts college, you take a women's studies class. And I was there, and I remember hearing about a study on uterine cancer. And this study was conducted using participants who were all men.
Yeah, wow.
So somehow they studied uterine cancer on male subjects.
And I was, what? That seems ludicrous. Yeah. What? How did they do that? How did they manage to study uterine cancer with all subjects who were men?
Yeah, well, nobody had it, so that was good. And this is, of course, my memory failing, but I don't remember the details. I just remember sitting in class and my jaw hit the floor and I said, that's where I belong. I belong in medicine where I can help mitigate the disparages in healthcare, promote research for women's healthcare because it is different. You can't do a study on uterine cancer involving only men. And so I think that was sort of a turning point for me.
Right. Among many things that you do, obviously, in your practice, and one of the reasons why we're talking here today, is that you also perform abortions. Do you ever become offended if someone refers to you as an abortion doctor, or do you prefer OBGYN as being your chosen path? Is there something that you seem that would maybe turn you off if someone said, oh, yeah, Dr. Torres, she's an abortion doctor? Is that how do you react to that label?
Well, I don't react negatively. I react sort of like, you know, it's a small part of what I do. It's actually quite small as far as all of the things that I do. Mm-hmm. More comprehensively is I'm an OBGYN. However, in the post Roe v. Wade, and so I'm talking decades, I think it's been important to distinguish that, yes, I also provide abortions. Mm-hmm. And that is, I think, part of the way some people communicate that is that she's an abortion doctor, and implied is, oh, she must be an OBGYN if she provides abortion, even though that is also not the case. You know, many different mid-level practitioners, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, you know, all sorts of people in different specialties can and do provide abortions, not just OBGYNs. But I'm not offended. It's where you get into the comments referring to the Holocaust, Dr. Mengele. That's an offensive
I would imagine.
Thing, right? You know, and that gets into all sorts of ridiculousness, but it's part of what I do. It's a small part.
Did you realize when you chose gynecology, obstetrics, and so on, that it would involve a particular procedure that would make you the target of not only protesters, but actually, in some cases, assassins and terrorists? I mean, did you, because it seems to me as of all the entirety of the medical field, it seems like this one area and narrowed down to OBGYNs or anyone who performs the abortion procedure would have to sort of factor that into their decision-making process that, yeah, this is going to be a risky area. I could be the subject of some sort of attack or series of protests or something like that. Did that cross your mind when you're originally going down this path? And do you fear for your life on a routine basis?
I did understand that there would be battles, right? I did understand that it would put me at risk.
Yeah.
I have throughout my career taken precautions. This actually all started in medical school when I decided to become a physician that provided abortion care. I went to a Medical Students for Choice conference down in Florida. I think it was being held in St. Petersburg, Florida. And I remember seeing a van with fetal parts plastered over the side of it. Ugh. And it was the blackgenocide.org van driving around the conference where we were having our conference. And it was then that I knew, yeah, I need to be here. I need to protect my patients. I need to do this because of people like that who think that they can harass and threaten. And let's make no mistake, these people who threaten me, threaten other abortion care providers, they are terrorists.
Yeah.
They're organized. They have killed and they want to kill and they will kill again. They have sent bombs. They have shot guns. They have killed people.
Yeah.
They are terrorists. And I make no qualms about calling them what they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's part of the driving force that keeps me providing abortion care and speaking up about it, because the only way to win against a bully is to confront them.
Yeah.
Hiding in silence and allowing them to shame and silence and stigmatize, that is not going to help people.
Right. So you actually went in with eyes open. Like, this is going to be part of the deal. If I want to do this, which is a serious profession, it's not, you're not doing something, you know, to use the old terms. I mean, you're not doing something in the back alleys. You're not a drug dealer. You're not some sort of a scam artist, or, you know, you're not any sort of criminal. But at the same time, you go into this field that is respectable and necessary, and yet you have this layer of treachery and potential bodily harm to you. It seems like that's not only a tough choice to make, but an extremely courageous one, because I assume based generally on your age that you came up in a time in which there were already the religious protests against the procedure and so on. So you were aware, but therefore you knew that this was going to be kind of a roll of the dice, right?
Oh, absolutely. And I appreciate those comments. It is, I am certainly not naive to the risk that is there. I take precautions. I try and protect myself and my family from the potential harm that could come of providing healthcare. And yeah, as you mentioned before, this is the only area of healthcare that is criminalized.
Yeah.
In the Utah legislative code, regulations surrounding abortion are listed under the chapter of crimes against the family.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
To illustrate further, regulations surrounding gun control and gun safety are listed under public health.
Unbelievable.
So you have definitely the criminalization of this area of medicine, and it exists nowhere else. There is no one criminalizing circumcisions.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's no one criminalizing anything in men's healthcare. There's no law that tells a man that he has to wait 24, 72 hours before a procedure. That those types of laws do not exist outside of women's reproductive health.
Yeah, there's no.
And so there was a. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, there's no urologist wearing Kevlar to work. You know what I mean?
Right. There's nothing. And so I think that if you kind of macroscopic view of it, you see all of these regulations, even the what is it? The church laws, the federal regulations that say physicians can conscientiously object to providing health care that is against their personal morals and ethics.
Mm-hmm.
That only applies to women's reproductive health. Mm-hmm. That does not apply to, say, an emergency room doctor who's a Jehovah's Witness. They are not allowed to say, I'm not going to give a blood transfusion
right. Because
of my religious views. That is not allowed. However, if they think that their patient who is unmarried should not have contraception, they're allowed to withhold that care. So it, you know, all of these regulations, all of this discrimination is focused on women's reproductive health.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, do you see protesters on a regular basis outside your practice?
My generalist practice is, because of Utah state law, is not where I provide abortion care. So generally, no.
Okay.
There's generally outside of clinics where abortion care is provided. Now in the West, those are very few and far between. Utah has some protesters. They tend to stand outside with their signs that say pray to end abortion. And I think if you're going to hold a sign that says pray to end abortion, you should probably be kneeling, but that's just my Catholic upbringing.
Right.
And at the same time, they're standing in 30 degree weather with small children in the rain. And I think, how are you going to decide for somebody else their parenting skills when you're out here with small children who are freezing, standing on a lawn? Like, it's just, it doesn't make any sense. Like, they don't seem to be able to cast stones, if you will.
Well, so you don't actually perform abortions, as you said, as part of your actual practice. So you have to go elsewhere. Do you go to other states? I mean, is this even something that you are at liberty to talk about? I mean, it almost seems like, I almost feel like we're speaking in hushed tones behind like closed doors in like a speakeasy. You bet we need to talk in coded language or something like that. And it just shouldn't be that way. And so, you know, but I go back to the question, which is that you said you have to go elsewhere. I mean, how does that work? Where do you go?
Well, and that is, and now we are in the hushed room behind closed doors, and you picked up appropriately. I mean, that's appropriate, and you definitely are hearing that, and that is the world that I live in now, given recent events in the past. Well, I guess almost a year now. I've had death threats, and so I have to be much more careful. And I have had to have investigations done into people who told me the day I was going to die.
Oh, my God.
That's pretty shocking.
Wow.
It goes beyond someone yelling at me on Twitter to, oh, my gosh, how accessible am I if somebody wants to hurt me?
Yeah.
So it's most of my work is done and, you know, joining podcasts like yours, going on Twitter, doing articles for Self Magazine. A lot of that is, and then the physical work is just the physical work.
Yeah.
But really what people get angry about is that I'm using my voice.
Right. Right. And I imagine because you are accessible, not only to people like me who are with you and support your work and obviously agree with your politics, but also you're very easily a target to the opposite end of that that spectrum. So, I mean, again, the fact that let's put it this way. No one is speaking in hushed tones about vasectomies. You know what I mean? So there's a bit of reproductive health that you can talk about wide open. Doesn't matter. You can go anywhere, do anything and say, oh, yeah, I had a vasectomy or I perform vasectomies. And you're not going to have to worry about, as I said earlier, you're not going to have to worry about wearing Kevlar to work or whether or not, you know, there's going to be a group of people holding grotesque and morbid signs outside of your house. And I don't think a lot of people understand that there are real life human beings who have medical degrees, who are doing these things, and they've become almost, and I'm not saying in the third person, but you have become almost to a degree a pariah for doing something that is entirely legal, at least according to the Supreme Court. It seems absolutely ludicrous. It seems, in and of itself, it seems criminal that you would have to do that.
No, and I appreciate that. It is difficult to swallow. Yeah. And pariah is absolutely an accurate term. There are several of us who provide abortions who understand what it feels like to be a pariah, despite our professional know-how and our good patient care and evidence-based medicine. The fact that abortion falls under any legal regulation is inappropriate. And to say that someone can't have an abortion as they need to violates all four principal medical ethics. And so these laws that don't let a doctor provide care to their patients violates medical ethics.
Yeah.
And yet it has become a political issue.
Mm-hmm.
And the only, I think, political issue that prevents people from actually obtaining the evidence-based health care that they need.
Right, right. You know, you said a second ago that you were brought up Catholic, and as was I. And in fact, that's why in my early, early formative years, I would say up until I was around 18 years old, I was, of course, you know, staunchly, you know, anti-choice. And I made my views aware in my high school newspaper. And but then, of course, you know, reality set in and facts, you know, seeped into my brain once I went off to college. And all of that changed, of course, because of, you know, science. It tends to enlighten people. And was there a point in time in which you had a similar epiphany where I don't know if you still practice Catholicism or if you've since left the church? I mean, how you ended up squaring, obviously, the Catholic Church being the most stridently anti-abortion, anti-choice. How did you make that transition?
Well, it really comes into more in discussing things with folks who are even within my own family, who do identify as Catholic, who do identify as religious, and who may understand why I do, why I provide abortion care, but don't understand, like, you know, how I can reconcile that. And it's pretty easy to reconcile the fact that there is someone who is pregnant, their health, their physiology is being changed. And if they want to undergo risks to their own health and life by continuing a pregnancy and giving birth, only they can decide that. That is between them and, in fact, their God. It is not up to me to decide that for them. So I never really struggled with, you know, the Catholic faith. I pretty much came to terms with not following the religion even before graduating high school. I was not practicing. I was not really, it didn't make sense to me at a young age. So, you know, I live by the golden rule, do unto others as you would have done unto you. And I find that quote religion end quote is sufficient to get me through anything, including providing abortion care. That is doing unto others as I would have done to me. If I were faced with a pregnancy that I did not want to continue, I would want somebody to provide a safe abortion for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people don't understand. I was on another podcast. I was a guest on a podcast myself earlier this week, and we got into this topic, which is that a lot of people don't understand. Even good Catholics don't get the fact that when Jesus came along, he announced the new covenant, and it was supposed to reject the old ways. And here were the new ways, which among them, love your neighbor as yourself. And it seems to me as if that that message is entirely lost on a gigantic group of people who identify as Catholic or identify as Christian in some way. They don't seem to understand the transition that took place upon the birth of Jesus, and at least in the context of the Bible, that this was supposed to be something brand new. Just something gets entirely lost along the way. But speaking of books, there's one that I've been citing as vital to this era, especially this era in politics. It's called The Death of Expertise by a moderate conservative and never Trumper named Tom Nichols, also a pro-choice. Basically, Americans are losing respect for expertise due to the internet and so many other things in media. And when I talk about this book, your name, Dr. Torres, often pops into my head because I've seen trolls on Twitter explaining reproductive biology to you, a reproductive biology expert. What goes through your head when you see this kind of doc-splaining crap on Twitter?
Oh, you just mentioned my YouTube channel called Doc-splaining.
There you go. See, I'm always thinking.
I'm taking it back is the thing. So I started a YouTube channel to counter exactly what you just mentioned. I find it interesting, and I think that one of my new teaching tools that I'm trying to use and trying to actually utilize myself in demonstrating to others is the whole, you can have your own beliefs, but you can't have your own facts. Yeah. And so getting into these discussions, I'm trying to use language because, again, as we know, language matters. Things, not saying, believe, do you believe, do you feel, but do you accept or deny the fact that? And so people will not answer the question. Yeah. Is how that ultimately turns out. Do you accept or deny the fact that pregnancy changes someone's physiology?
Mm-hmm.
Do you accept or deny the fact that no one loses their personal autonomy at any point in pregnancy? Do you, you know, so you, we need to change the way that we're having these discussions. I used to have to focus on going, finding an agreement between, are we having a religious philosophical discussion or are we having a scientific fact based discussion? That's where we have to start. We have to agree on the playing field. Then using language such as, this is a fact. You may accept it or reject it, but it doesn't change it as a fact.
Yeah.
And I think that that's where we need to be, is holding people accountable for whether or not they accept or deny facts.
Mm-hmm.
People have all sorts of feelings. People have feelings about all sorts of different things. And yes, we should celebrate our differences and our different feelings and all of that. But you don't get to say climate change is a bunch of hooey because you feel like that would be easier.
Yeah.
No, this is fact. This has been decades of knowledge already known.
Mm-hmm.
You don't just get to show up and say, no, I don't believe in it. That's fine. But the belief is the wrong word. You can say, I reject these facts.
Yeah.
And then you look foolish.
Right.
But so be it. That's your right to look foolish.
Yeah. By the same token, and in more of a general sense, do you find, and this is also covered in this book, The Death of Expertise, and part of this dangerous trend, I think, in American discourse, do you find that as a doctor, you get a lot of patients coming in saying, oh, you know what, this commercial told me to ask you about Provasic or some other medication, and then suddenly your patients are dictating to you what you ought to prescribe to them when it should really be the other way? You being the expert, you probably know better than most what your patient with X, Y, and Z symptoms or conditions should probably receive, what kind of treatment they should get. Do you find that's happening a lot more now that pharmaceutical commercials are so pervasive in American media?
You know, I don't, but I think that's because of where my specialty is.
Mm-hmm.
So in women's health, pharmaceutical companies aren't exactly investing a lot in women's health, right?
Yeah. Well, what a shock. Yeah.
Right. And I think that actually speaks volumes more. But I do have patients who come in, you know, I saw this on the internet or I looked up these symptoms. Is this what I have? And that's fine. But they often end with, but you're the doctor, so I wanted to ask you.
Mm-hmm.
So that's reassuring. I think that I feel like the media and the sort of doc-splaining gets into more of the political realms of medicine.
Yeah.
And less so than the personal, I have these symptoms, I want to do this, this is what I saw on TV. So I think that that's reassuring.
Yeah. You know, it seems like many of the trap laws specifically are a manifestation of this denialism of expertise. For example, there's no medical evidence that fetuses feel pain before the third trimester, right? But the AMA says there's no evidence for it occurring before then. Yet trap laws passed in 20 different states, 20 states suggest fetuses feel pain at 20 weeks. Are there obstetricians out there telling legislators that it's 20 weeks? Where are they getting this information? Or are they just using a dartboard and coming up with, oh, it's arbitrarily 20 weeks?
That's a dartboard. 20 weeks is where you have.
Yeah.
I mean, there you go. 20 weeks is where you have the ultrasound for anatomy to look at, you know, the structures of the fetus and see that the heart is okay, the brain is okay, the kidneys are there, and all of these sorts of things. That's why they arbitrarily chose 20 weeks, is because that's when an ultrasound is done.
Yeah.
So what they want to do is prevent anyone from exercising their ability to have an abortion for an abnormal fetus.
Right.
Because why would someone not want to give birth and watch an infant die because they have a lethal condition? I mean, that sounds like great old fun, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So I have sat across the table from a legislator who put forward the fetal anesthesia bill here in Utah, had a one-on-one discussion with him, and he looked me straight in the face and said, well, thank you for your time.
Unbelievable.
And passed the bill anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm one person, but the legislature also had a letter signed by 24 maternal fetal medicine experts condemning the bill, and it still passed. So this is exactly what you're talking about, is that we experts are speaking up, but the point is not to do what's right. The point is to do what the people who are paying them want them to do, because it's all about money and power.
Yep.
And if there's any doubt about that, this is these trap laws are hard evidence that our legislators do not represent the people.
Mm-hmm.
They represent their stature and their pockets.
Yeah, it seems like the goal is to not set a red line at actual scientific evidence. The goal, it seems to me, is if with some of these trap laws that involve the weeks of gestation, seems like that's more to just narrow the window in which abortion can occur legally in a particular state. And it tends to change depending on which state you go into. But it seems like that. Like, it's just like, okay, and this is obvious, so I'm not breaking any news here, but it just seems like, let's make it more and more difficult to actually gain this procedure, to allow women to have this procedure. Let's make it next to impossible, and therefore it becomes a backdoor ban, right? It's a way to get around Roe, in a sense, where we're still allowing it, but only in this teeny tiny narrow window.
Oh, exactly. It is absolutely that. And the motivation is not for good deeds. The motivation is for the masses who are so staunchly anti-choice that they can't see the forest for the trees.
Yeah.
And the only, right abortion is their own abortion, because these folks who protest are also coming in with their undesired pregnancies and having abortions and then going right back out and protesting. So it has nothing to do with ideology and everything to do with position and power.
Right, right. In fact, there's a new anti-choice bill, and it's in fact labeled the most extreme anti-choice bill yet, shockingly, in Florida. What a surprise. And it bans abortion after 6 weeks, which is completely arbitrary, knowing that a lot of women don't even realize that they're pregnant at 6 weeks, right?
Correct. That's why that timeline was chosen.
Yeah. And the bill also, by the way, bans the word fetus and replaces it with unborn human being. Again, a lawmaker rewriting scientific terms, thus denying expertise, denying science, denying women the right to this legal procedure. And this seems like a loaded question, but what is this law getting so terribly wrong? Walk us through this. Why is this so, so horrible?
Well, what is it getting right? That would be easier.
Yeah, okay. In those terms, what is it?
The answer there is
nothing. Yeah. Yeah.
What is it getting wrong? What it's getting wrong is revoking basic autonomy to someone with a positive pregnancy test.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's getting wrong.
Yeah.
It's under the guise of defining a person.
Mm-hmm.
So not defining a human being, because people are pregnant with human beings. We are Homo sapiens. We are a species, that is the species human beings. But what it is doing is it is assigning personhood to an embryo.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, well, let's just take it fully, shall we?
Mm-hmm.
Because anyone having a miscarriage then should be charged with involuntary manslaughter.
Right.
Because who knows that, the 3 cigarettes that you had last week didn't cause the miscarriage.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate the term slippery slope, but if you're going to call a spade, then let's go full gamut.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to say an embryo with a heartbeat is a person, because that's essentially what this law is saying, well, then that person is physiologically dependent upon the one who's pregnant. And therefore, that person is going to take priority because it is the most vulnerable, to use their terms.
Yeah.
So now you've got pregnancies taking priority over the people pregnant with them.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've got someone who cannot refuse a C-section in labor.
Right.
Because the fetus is more important than they are.
Yep.
And so if I see that this kid is dying and I say, hey, we got to go back for a C-section. And she says, no, I say too bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I perform a surgery that she doesn't want against her will. That's where that goes.
Yeah.
Right. But you don't get to just stop at banning 6-week abortions. It goes that far. And so what you get wrong is you revoke the personhood of the one who's pregnant.
Right.
In order to prioritize the pregnancy. That is what is wrong.
Yeah. It's entirely a body sovereignty thing. It's the intrusion into a woman's body by the state. And it seems to me as if the libertarian wing of the conservative movement should be most interested in protecting that. But instead what they're doing, I mean, one of the most anti-abortion, anti-choice politicians in the United States right now is Ron Paul and Rand Paul, his son. They are horrible when it comes to this issue, going so far as to wanting to, you know, as you were saying earlier, to actually criminalize doctors and women who actually have the procedure, to make that, an act of murder in a sense. Just going back to this Florida law, at 6 weeks, what are we talking about in terms of embryonic development at that point? At 6 weeks, are we still looking at basically a multi-celled organism, or what is the stage of development at that point?
Well, the stage of development is altering the pregnant person's physiology and physiologically utilizing their resources.
Yeah.
I mean, people often get into the discrepancies between a 6-week fetus and a 20-week fetus, and what is a zygote versus an embryo versus a fetus.
Yeah.
It's really arbitrary, honestly. I don't see that helping the issue, because when I hear even those who are staunchly pro-choice say, quote, clump of cells, to some, yeah, but everyone has their own pregnancy experience. And I think it's important to acknowledge that someone who's pregnant may not have wanted to get pregnant, but now that they are very excited about it, right? Yeah. There are people who were trying to get pregnant, got pregnant and had a horrible mishap in the development and have to have an abortion, and they are extremely sad.
Yeah.
So what a 6-week embryo, fetus, whatever is, it's that person's pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
What does that person think it is? Like, I mean, I can describe shapes and what it is, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
What matters is what that person who's pregnant, what they feel, what they think.
Obviously, there's the adjoining question of, and this is an extraordinarily loaded and generic question that gets asked in the context of this debate all the time. Does life begin at conception? And generally speaking, my untrained response to that is, well, technically speaking, the life cycle begins at conception, but there's a distinction that occurs upon birth. Is that a fair assessment to make, or am I getting the science wrong and I'm not looking at it the right way? And I'm not saying that from the perspective of being like a scold when it comes to, obviously I'm pro-choice, but there are a lot of people who use this argument to their advantage to try to ban abortion, or try to suggest that this is an individual and we need to protect that individual above all else.
Right. And the mistake that's made is having that discussion in the first place.
You're rejecting the premise of the question. There you go.
I do, because here's the thing. The question of life, that's a philosophical question.
Yeah.
My idea of life is different from your idea of life, is different from somebody who lives in India's idea of life, right?
Yeah.
To try and find common ground there is futile.
Mm.
And the point is that regardless of when one believes philosophically when life begins, the one who's pregnant already has a life.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And their life is going to supersede that of the pregnancy. That is biology.
Right.
That is reproductive physiology. Again, we're talking about facts. And until that umbilical cord is cut at birth, when a baby is delivered, that is at the time where that now infant, because it's been born,
mm-hmm.
is physiologically independent. But until that point, it required the lungs, the heart, the blood, the mm-hmm. uterus, the placenta of the one who was pregnant.
Right.
So when does life begin? Doesn't matter. The pregnant person is alive and has a life worth protecting. And without their life, that pregnancy doesn't even exist.
Yeah.
Neither do future pregnancies.
Exactly.
If they want to be pregnant again.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think getting into the when does life begin? I mean, I get this all the time on social media, but it's a life. If you want to believe that, that's fine. It doesn't change the fact that pregnancy is physiologically dependent upon the pregnant person.
Yeah. Which is why I think elective abortion should be just as protected as medically necessary abortion, because it is, you know, it is still, the priority is still the woman who is carrying that particular fetus or embryo or whatever the terminology happens to be at that stage. I assume that that's a fair point to make, wouldn't you think?
I have to change your vernacular.
Okay. Okay, please do.
So the term elective,
mm-hmm.
that implies that there's not a medical reason to do it.
Yeah.
That's what the term elective means. It often gets confused with, you know, something that's an emergency versus a non-emergency. No. Mm-hmm. Elective means it's not really medically necessary, but let's do it, and but it'll make you feel better in these ways, whatever. Every abortion is indicated because someone is pregnant and they do not want to be pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
So 100% of abortions have an indication. Now, they may not want to be pregnant because there's something severely wrong with the fetus. They may not want to be pregnant because they were raped by their uncle and they don't want to bring a child into the world, mm-hmm. whatever. They may not want to be pregnant because they could die in giving birth. They may not want to be pregnant because they can't take care of the children that they have. All of these are the next like set of reasons, right? The reasons that we talk about. But the fact of the matter is that every abortion occurs because someone who is pregnant does not want to be pregnant. And that is the only solution to that problem of being pregnant and being and not wanting to be pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be where I would change the vernacular. I strike out anytime someone says elective abortion, I strike that out, explaining mm-hmm. this very reasoning.
Yeah.
So the versus what you had said was medically indicated, I think what you're referring to is those who wanted to be pregnant, but something went wrong.
Right.
Right. That is, yes, a different patient, sort of a different situation where you desire to be pregnant, you desire to give birth, but now you're faced with an abnormality and that changes things.
Yeah.
Same procedures, different patients. Also, people having a miscarriage.
Mm-hmm.
I may have to do a DNC procedure on someone having a miscarriage. Same procedure, different patient.
Right.
So to treat someone having a miscarriage as someone the same as someone coming in needing an abortion, not the same.
Okay.
You can't lump everybody together in the same same pot, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was thinking in terms of the economic reasons for choosing to have an abortion, and again, it goes under that umbrella, as you were saying, of of a medical necessity, but at the same time, what triggers that, I guess, is in this case, you know, it's impossible to pay for this. I don't have health insurance, or I'm not prepared to have a child and pay, you know, save up for college and be able to have the money to, you know, I'm between jobs, or, you know, there are lots of economic reasons for wanting to pursue an abortion. But I have this this little trap that I tend to throw out there to kind of bait anti-choice people, and that's the notion of making pregnancy free. Like, what if we were to make pregnancy entirely free and remove that as a concern? Thus, you know, according to some statistics, around 75% of abortions occur as a consequence of economic concerns. I said, well, if you strip that out, you'd actually kind of be reducing abortions by 75%. So don't you want to make pregnancy free? And suddenly the answer is basically, and so, you know, you kind of.
You kind of corner them into. What we don't have is, for example, breastfeeding in the workplace.
Right.
That's not even allowed. So you can't tell me that you want me to have a kid and then not let me feed it and provide for it. Like, do you want me to feed it at home and not work? Or do you want me to work and have a kid? Like, what do you want?
Mm-hmm.
So until we have, and this is what anyone who is in medicine, I would argue, who is even those in medicine who are against abortion, I think what we can all agree on, and this is the common ground that I go to when having discussions with folks who don't have the same views as me, what we all want is reproductive health free of coercion.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is someone doesn't have to worry about putting food on the table. And if they're pregnant, they can say safely, well, I'll be able to provide for this child. So do I want to be pregnant and give birth, or do I not want to be pregnant and give birth? That's where the decision comes in.
Yeah.
Right. As opposed to, I don't know how I'm going to feed this kid, so I need to have an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it would be great if reproductive health decisions went down to that basic fact of, do I want to undertake the risks of pregnancy and give birth, or do I not?
Right.
Because that's still a thing.
Yep.
But then you get all of these other factors in, and our society does not value what it takes for people to be pregnant and give birth.
Yeah. This is such a great point. There's obviously copious amounts of ignorance out there in terms of what is involved just with a woman's personal health as they go through that entire process, the physiological changes, the hormonal changes, the sacrifice that is required to carry a pregnancy to term and then to go on from there. The complications are staggering, and there are so many, specifically men, who don't get the basic biology of it, much less what it takes emotionally and physically to endure that, right?
Absolutely. But then you get the devaluation of that as the, oh, it's just what you do.
Yeah.
So if I had my way, and I've said this several times publicly, we would hold parades every day in honor for anyone willing to go through a pregnancy and give birth.
Yeah.
Because that's a big freaking deal.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is so many sacrifices. And then on top of that, to commit the next two decades to rearing that new human being into an adult member of society.
Yeah.
Right? And it's often not just two decades, you know, goes beyond that.
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand how that is so undermined by our society as that's just what you do.
Yeah.
Yeah. you bleed 2 liters of blood giving birth. No big deal.
Like, right.
No, it's a huge deal.
Like, yes.
That's a big deal.
Mm.
I don't understand how people can say having an abortion is bad, but at the same time, don't breastfeed. You have the kid. Now we don't care about it. I don't really want to invest in education. If you want to go to college, you should go into student debt for tens of thousands of dollars in order to do it. We don't value our future.
Yeah.
We don't put any investment in our kids and the education, in higher education, so that when I'm old, I have a doctor to take care of me.
Yeah. I assure you that if there was a medical procedure for men specifically that involved an episiotomy, I think there would be a lot fewer men getting themselves into that situation where they would have to endorse something like that. Something that, you know, just as a layperson seems really harsh and kind of, you know, destructive in terms of the anatomy of that area. Just the entire birthing process just seems like something, you know, and I like the old cliche that, if men got pregnant, there'd be an abortion clinic on every street corner attached to McDonald's. You'd go in and get a hamburger and have an abortion on the side. And, it just seems like that would be the way, because it is so, I mean, when I think about someone getting pregnant, I think, well, congratulations. At the same time, I go, oh, my God, what you must have to endure now is terrifying. I mean, as a man, I just like look into it and go, oh, my God, I can't believe you're going to have to go through all of those things. It just seems like a huge sacrifice.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
it is. It's terrifying as a woman. And it's terrifying as an obstetrician as well.
I can't even imagine.
I'm an educated person. I am trained in all of this, and I see what happens. Basically, right. Terrifying. Pregnancy is terrifying. It should be respected, but it isn't.
I can't even imagine the kinds of complications that you witness on a daily basis, whether it's with a pregnancy or whether it's with the process of childbirth. It just seems like the varieties of horrible things that you must have to endure, but also the varieties of fulfilling things at the same time. Do those things balance themselves out for you?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, you know, when you're taking care of people who are pregnant and giving, you know, helping them give birth and taking care of them there, you see a lot of great things. The great of the great, but then the sad of the sad is also tragic. So, you get the best of the best, but also the worst of the worst. More often than not, obviously the best of the best. But it's those tough cases where something bad happens. It is really rough.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, my mom used to work at an OBGYN's office where she was an office manager, and she would come home with just terrible, terrible stories. Women not changing the circumcision dressing on their children, and horrible infections. Oh my God, the terrible, terrible stories that she would bring home. It was fun dinner conversation.
Oh, it is.
Why do you think it's so difficult to convince anti-choicers that free and universal birth control reduces abortion? It seems like a no-brainer to me, isn't it?
Well, it's not about abortion so much as it is about female sexuality.
Yeah, exactly.
There's a whole, if you want to, again, kind of macroscopic view, go back in time historically, blah, blah, blah. Everything points to the control of female sexuality in order to control the reproduction of the species. I mean, that's why sex outside of marriage is shamed. That's why marriage was even instilled. That's why homosexuality is bad, is because all of these things point to female sexuality and sex for pleasure, which is what our species does.
Yeah.
But then that results in an uncontrollable situation regarding not having control over the reproduction of the species.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all about shaming women, shaming their sexuality. You know, men get to have all the sex they want. Women are sluts if they have a lot of sex, you know. Yeah. It's all of this is boiled down to a fear of one of the two genders, and I'm just going to make this easy in binary genders here.
Mm-hmm.
The one side having more reproductive power than the other.
Yeah.
That's what this is about.
Mm-hmm.
And so to balance that, the answer was, well, let's shame female sexuality and let's make sure that they only have sex when we want them to, so that we can control the population of the species.
Yep, exactly right. In fact, George Carlin used to do a great bit about that, about how it's not really about abortion. It's about how it's about controlling women. It's just the bottom line. It's about controlling women's lives and controlling their rights, controlling their personal sovereignty over what goes on inside their bodies. I mean, it just continues on and on. And that tends to be the common denominator in all of this conversation. But, you know, it's interesting that you went down this road because it's your bio on Twitter says that you promote healthy sexual practices. What aspects do you cover specifically? We're kind of moving away from, you know, abortion at this point into this area. But what do you mean by that when you say that in your Twitter bio?
That means most of all communication, and specifically communication surrounding consent.
Yeah.
Surrounding consent, surrounding pleasure, surrounding healthy sexual interpersonal relationships. And what I find, especially here in Utah, is that that is non-existent. So I have people who've been married for 30 years coming to me saying, is there something wrong with my hormones, or are we just not able to talk about sex because we've been brainwashed into thinking sex is bad?
Yeah.
I'm like, well, it's actually more the latter, but let's talk about all the things, you know? And so promoting healthy sexual practices is really, in our culture today, I think more than anything is just talking about sex, talking about what one likes, what one doesn't like, what one, you know, what makes one feel good and all of those things, and having a healthy, open, back and forth communication with partner and partners, by the way, doesn't have to be just one partner, you know, like that, opening that up, and that we are not necessarily a monogamous species, but that gets into a whole nother
I mean,
that's basically what I'm talking about.
Why don't people, especially, let's say, and again, going the most simple route, let's say, you know, a binary a situation with genders and so on, where why don't men and women talk about what they like and what they want to have done to them in a sexual situation? Why is there such resistance to that? And I know some of the answers to this questions, but coming from an expert, I mean, what do you see as being the cause of that? Why is this so difficult to say, well, this, if you do that, that makes me feel good, or that will lead me up to having an abortion, so please do that, and or vice versa? Why doesn't that happen?
Well, hopefully it happens more than we might know, because we can't be in everybody's business. But I think it's mostly, not mostly, but I think a lot of what leads to that is the social messaging that kids hear, right? So kids hear that girls are supposed to be pure and perfect and not have sexual desire. And if a girl has such sexual desire, then there's something wrong with her.
Yeah.
I'm oversimplifying. This is the social messaging that is out there. It's what I got when I was a kid, right? As opposed to having these feelings are normal, and here's how you talk about these feelings with your partner, and here's, you know, what consent looks like. And if you want to do something, then you should make sure that your partner wants to do that thing as well. And if you don't want to do something, you should speak up, and your partner should not have to feel like they've done something wrong or feel shame, you know? Yeah. So there's a whole, like, how we talk to our children who are growing up and becoming of the age that is appropriate to have these discussions. I'm not saying talk to 3-year-olds about sex. That would be silly and futile, to say the least. But as they're growing into their teenage years and getting into puberty and understanding their bodies and how pleasure feels, don't hide it. That just encourages the shame. And then you've got them finding out the answers to these questions on their own. And that is not good.
Right.
When they're asking their peers, or they're looking on the internet.
Yes.
Or, you know, if you, you know, use watermelon lotion before having sex, then you can't get pregnant. That's not good. Like, that's not good. We need to have an open communication with our kids.
Yep.
That is healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And they come to their parents or their teachers, or I would appreciate it if they would be their parents, but sometimes even to their doctors, like me, with questions before engaging in behavior that might put them at risk for either assault, pregnancy, sexually transmitted infections, all of these things. But we can't seem to do that as a society because we are so sexually repressed, and we keep getting repressed from organized religions, here in Utah, it's the LDS Church. It's Catholicism elsewhere. It's baptism elsewhere. It's, you know, you can't, if you're a species like we are, that is sexual and has sex for pleasure, you can't just pretend that's not a thing.
Right. Yeah.
That is so crucial.
It really, really is.
To acknowledge that.
And I find, too, in addition to religion, I find that mass media, specifically movies, television shows and everything, I think lead people to certain conclusions when it comes to sex. I think the idea is that in a lot of ways, men feel like, well, I need to be perceived as if I know what I'm doing. And in fact, a lot of women automatically expect that the man that they're with should know what he's doing. And so therefore I shouldn't say anything to them. But then there's this other dynamic where if women do say something to their man to say, well, I prefer you do this and don't do that, but try this other thing, that men will tend to get insulted or, for lack of a better term, butthurt and have their feelings crushed in some way, where in fact, a lot of men will just get up and walk out of the room, go take a shower or something like that.
And here's that side of the coin is important as well, because there is messaging to young men out there about all sorts of unhealthy things, like don't cry, don't show your emotions.
Yeah.
Be good in bed, like, because you just know how. That's unreasonable, to say the very least, but it's also damaging to these young men. Absolutely.
You know, one of the topics, in fact, that we've discussed recently on my After Party show, which is co-hosted by Kimberly, who you spoke with a year ago on her show, we often talk about orgasms and why so many women go unfulfilled during heterosexual sex, leading to faking it, and sometimes for men, a false sense of accomplishment or machismo, despite not actually triggering an orgasm or doing anything along those lines, or even not even coming close in a lot of cases. Do you see this as the rule or the exception, where there's just this gigantic disconnect when it comes to an understanding of women and orgasms?
Well, hypothetically speaking, because I couldn't speak to this personally, you know.
Well, yes, I'm speaking to you as a scientist, as an expert, right?
Scientifically speaking, not at all personal experience. So I think there is still, even now, even amongst myself, my peers, there's this fear of hurting your partner's feelings.
Yeah.
Right? Like that is a thing. And that is something that, again, I was receiving messaging from a very young age. Male partners have been receiving. What I do find is, if communication has opened up, you can tell right away the quote unquote, like, sexually progressive, if we want to like use a term as opposed to the sexually repressed or oppressed, right off by saying, you know what, do this.
Yeah.
And you will see, in my experience with male partners, like their eyes light up, like, oh, thank you. Kind of like,
right.
Thanks. Like men seem to be grateful for their partners being able to say, instead of them like shooting in the dark. Right.
Yeah.
So, but there's this holdback of women receiving this messaging that men are supposed to just know.
Mm.
So, and a lot of times women don't know, because they've been told that masturbation is bad. So like you get into all these crazy like dynamics because of being a Victorian society and a puritanical society, like,
yep,
people don't know themselves, which will naturally inhibit any communication about sexual desire, pleasure, etc. So you gotta like, you gotta just start the communication, but if nobody's ever allowed to talk about it, then this problem is going to continue.
Right. And you know,
women not speaking up and men feeling like they have to know everything.
And you know, forgive me if I'm being too forward with this questioning. I hope you're not offended by going down this road, because I obviously am interested from a biological point of view. This isn't to be salacious or titillating in the format of a podcast or anything like that. These are all legitimate questions about the biology of how this works and what you may have experienced dealing with human sexuality through not only your practice but your work online and activism and so on. So that's the origin of all this. I want to be completely clear and upfront about all of that.
I'm with you on that, absolutely.
Well, and especially before I ask this question, which is often a topic of discussion, and increasingly so as the internet becomes a format in which people discuss their sexuality and discuss their own pleasure and are more open about this. I mean, I can tell you that talking about, for men especially, talking about the fact that they masturbate, you know, I'm willingly able to admit now publicly that I've masturbated many, many times. But, you know, 20 years ago, that was something that you kept to yourself. Otherwise, you were going to be made fun of. You know, it's just so the morals and the ethics of sexuality and especially the discussion of sexuality has changed over the years. So I guess the question I want to ask you is, where do you land on the topic of vaginal orgasms? Because there is a lot of debate, and I think the jury is still out in terms of whether it even exists, because I know some women who never had one and never will, and they can only have a clitoral orgasm, they can't have a vaginal orgasm, and there's also science that kind of backs that up too, but it's obviously still for open debate. Where do you land on that?
Well, I land in the science.
Yeah.
The clitoris is the organ responsible for orgasms.
Right.
Right. So that is located, if you, I'm going to use anatomical terms. It's anterior vaginal wall. So
right.
It's the top of the vagina, basically. Mm. It's up in there, if you will. But it's not just, you know, people think of the clitoral hood, that little button, the man in the little boat on the outside, right? That's one very small part of the entire organ. Mm-hmm. So if you look up online what a clitoris actually is, you'll see that it's an organ that actually kind of surrounds the top of the vagina, almost like it's straddling the tunnel that is the vagina.
Yeah.
Okay, so you get stimulation from outside of the vagina on the top where that clitoral hood is, but also from the inside. Anal sex can be pleasurable because penetrating the anus can put pressure on the anterior vaginal wall as well. It's all the vagina is collapsible.
Yeah.
So the clitoris is the key.
Right.
Women can stimulate their clitoris in a variety of ways. However they find is the best stimulation from whatever angle with whatever pressure, all of that varies.
Mm-hmm.
Just like men and their masturbatory experiences. Some men are less pressure, some are more pressure, some are fast, some are slow, and it depends on the mood, right? So just like a penis has varying degrees of pleasure from friction, from pressure, from speed, from rhythm, all that stuff, so does the clitoris. It's just located internally.
Yeah.
And so vaginal orgasm is merely, if you will, what I think I understand is stimulation from only penetrating the vagina.
Right.
As opposed to penetrating the vagina, not penetrating the vagina, doing a mixture of pressure on the outside versus pressure from the inside. You know, there is more variety of how this clitoris can be stimulated because it is an internal organ that can be stimulated from a variety of ways, I guess.
Yeah.
So I think that it's up to the clitoris haver to know how their clitoris works and to tell their partner or partners, this is what works for my clitoris. This is what works for my orgasm. This is what I enjoy.
And so women who say that they have had vaginal orgasms, would you say that they're either telling their partners that they are, and they really are faking it, or they believe that they have. And I think there are a lot of women who swear up and down, oh my God, I did have a vaginal orgasm, but it's not technically an orgasm. Is that the case?
No, because they can have vaginal orgasms. Absolutely. Because the clitoris again is on is essentially straddling the tunnel that is the vagina, just that it's at the anterior or the top wall of the vagina. So
interesting.
You can have stimulation from vaginal penetration, absolutely.
But wouldn't that still be a clitoral orgasm, though? If it's stimulating sort of the legs of the clitoris, you know what I mean?
They're all clitoral orgasms.
Okay. All right. That's the answer to the question. Yeah. That's what I was looking for.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in fact, one of the bits of information I recall from fetal biology in college, I had I took as an undergrad, for some reason, because I was masochistic, I took a master's level fetal biology course because I really liked the professor. But in that process of taking that class, I learned the science of the homologous organs, the relationship between, for example, the testicles and ovaries, or the clitoris and the penis, and how they are similar and they have a similar origin in fetal development. Do you subscribe to the notion that an understanding of these homologous organs would then lead to a greater understanding of sexuality and pleasure? And do you think that that would be helpful as being a part of opening up the sexual dialogue?
I think the more information is always helpful. I don't think it's honestly, I don't think it's a groundbreaking piece of knowledge. I think we've known the homologous organs for a while. So I think more what's important is that what I see is sexual repression or oppression. Mm. People repress themselves from societal oppression. And that's the problem. So when you're told from a very young age that masturbation is a sin, you're going to have a lot of problems later because you're not going to know how to communicate with your partner what feels good because you yourself don't know what feels good.
Yeah.
That is what is the case here in Utah, where the LDS Church tells young children that masturbation is bad. And so then they are wrought with sexual pleasure being mixed with guilt, being mixed with sin, being mixed with I'm not allowed to, like, it's just so, it's hugely damaging.
Mm-hmm.
Hugely damaging.
Yeah.
And it's tragic because then I do get people who've been married for years who can't talk to each other because one, they can't talk about sex. Two, they don't masturbate, so they don't know what feels good. And three, like, it just all falls apart.
Yeah.
And it's surrounded in this psychological torture from messaging that they've received. It's horrible.
Yeah. And in fact, I found with a lot of men, they feel like whether their partner tells them this outright or whether their partner leads them down this road without saying anything in a more passive aggressive way. But I feel like a lot of men feel as if they masturbate, then they're somehow cheating on their partner. When in fact, I think a lot of women might appreciate the fact that their man is pleasuring himself and not demanding that she do it. It seems to me as if that's a healthier perspective on self pleasure. But, and in fact, it could go the opposite way too. Women masturbating and so it goes, I think, both ways. I think the door swings both ways on that, but it seems like masturbation in and of itself is an area where you get, I think a lot of people get into that whole idea of cheating. And it seems to me as if that's counterproductive to a healthy relationship, actually. Do you follow that? Does that make sense to you?
That makes sense. And it is a very foreign concept to me as someone who tries to continue learning about sexuality, about people's sexuality so they can help them be healthier in their sexuality. It is a foreign concept that masturbation would be a form of, quote, cheating. I understand the thought process there, but that is, of course, again, that is an unhealthy approach to sexuality, whether it's your own or your partner's. I am a longtime listener of Dan Savage. I don't know if you're familiar with his work.
He's the best. Yeah.
Right. So I, you know, quote him all the time, but, you know, he has talked a lot about, you know, the consumption of porn and how porn can actually save marriages because honestly, for the one with the vagina who is getting penetrated, who is like, that can be exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and he talks about that. It's the receiver can, you know, it can be exhausting. And so if my partner, for example, is going to masturbate and I'm whatever, I don't care. Great.
Yeah.
I don't think that is an affront. I think that is him exercising his own sexuality. And I think that's great. if he wants to consume porn, I do not feel that that is a threat to me.
Mm-hmm.
Just like if I consume porn, he should not feel it's a threat to him. And so, you know, people have these insecurities, and that's really what it is stemming from. It's from insecurities. It's from messaging they've received that is toxic, and it's unfortunate. But I think that if, again, if people had better communication surrounding their own sexuality, their own pleasure, their own masturbation. I mean, I masturbate. I'm a human being. That is what human beings do.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yes. Some more than others.
Some more than others. And right. Like people, just like libidos are different amongst people. Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, libidos change. They change with time. They change with what's going on in your life. So that's all natural. That's all part of human physiology.
Yeah.
And it's to be celebrated. I mean, we have sex to reduce stress and to bond better. Oxytocin is released when people orgasm, and it is a great stress reducing hormone. It is a great bonding hormone. I mean, the physiologic reasons for having sex alone should convince anyone that sex is not just for making babies.
Right.
That is a very small part of why we have sex.
Yeah. Just don't ask the Republicans whether it's that's the point. One last question for you, Dr. Torres, and I feel bad. I'm now looking at the clock, and we're now an hour and 15 minutes in. And you can, of course, hang up on me anytime you want. But this one last question. If you could doc-splain to men one thing about female anatomy, what would it be? Is that a tough question? Yeah, loaded question or hard question or both?
No. We have brains and we like to use them.
Yeah, there you go.
How about that?
That's perfect. That's a perfect way. Thank you. Yeah. Well, you know, you'd be surprised about how many men, and we've seen them protesting Gillette to come full circle now. We've seen them protesting Gillette all over Twitter, flushing their razor blades that they purchased. Like idiots, flushing them down the toilet. And and of course, the message is that, men need to just be a little less toxic with their behavior. And it's not all men, and it's not, not every guy is a genocidal maniac. That's not the point of the Gillette commercial. But to stow that attitude moving forward is definitely a positive thing. So. But Dr. Torres, it was such a pleasure to talk with you. Of course, I could pick your brain about this stuff all damn day. But thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much, Bob. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks. We'll talk to you next time.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.